This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear about a San Luis Obispo County nonprofit that serves as a sort of housing matchmaker.
As the demographics are shifting and more people are living alone, we definitely have too many, you know, three-bedroom homes that are way too large for one person, not to mention completely unaffordable.
Also, we'll take a look at the current state of the San Luis Obispo County tourism industry.
If you were to go on our website today, you would see photos of people in masks that are helping to sell and educate. If you're going to come here, please follow the rules accordingly.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, August 31st, 2020. I'm Carol Tangeman. More than 173,000 people have died of the coronavirus in the United States. It's hard to imagine each of these humans individually, the families they've left behind and what their lives were like. KVPR's Alice Daniel has the story of one of them, a Hmong businessman and filmmaker who had a profound impact on thousands of others. 72-year-old Su Tao died of COVID-19 in July. His funeral took place this past weekend in Fresno.
What you're hearing is a documentary produced in Burma in the late 90s. Two young Hmong women in traditional dress are dancing encircled by other villagers. They're singing a goodbye song to filmmaker Su Tao, who came from Fresno to make this video. Here's his son, Steve Tao.
He went to Burma to find kind of like the lost Hmong people there. Did a documentary, the whole town came out to welcome him, and he had a conversation with the village elders.
A lively conversation full of laughter. It was a big deal, Steve says, because it gave other Hmong communities all over the world a chance to compare culture, history, and life experiences. But it was also a dangerous trip because of Burma's civil war. By the time Su Tao made this documentary, he'd already been a well-known film distributor of videos dubbed in Hmong, mostly romantic and action films from Thailand, as well as films from Bollywood.
A lot of the homes in America would have these videos. We would send, thousands of videos across the country.
Steve says his dad also made documentaries of his native Laos in the early 90s, years after he and thousands of other Hmong came to the United States as refugees.
The government was still closed off to most people, so it was really an amazing thing for people here to see Hmong people in Laos, see the land of their forefathers and see some of their relatives on video.
For 15 years, the U.S. fought a secret war against the Communist Pathet Lao and the North Vietnamese, not with American troops, but with native Laotians instead, tens of thousands of them, Hmong tribesmen.
Like many older Hmong refugees in Fresno, Su fought in the CIA's secret war in Laos. Steve Tao says his dad, who spoke English, was a second lieutenant and helped direct bombers and fighter pilots on air missions. When the Pathet Lao won the Civil War in 1975, Su and his family tried to get on one of the planes that General Vang Pao had brought in for officers like him. Steve was only 5 years old.
I think it was the last C-130, and I remember him throwing me onto the plane, and I just remember the image of people all over. And there's an iconic picture of a C-130 with thousands of people around it.
Su and Steve both got on the plane headed to Thailand, but somehow in the crush of desperate people pushing to get on board, Su's pregnant wife and daughter got separated from him and didn't make it on the plane. Many of Su's other family members were also stuck in Laos. His niece, Tru Chang, says her family was terrified Vietnamese soldiers would kill them. But one night,
they heard footsteps outside the door. They thought, oh my gosh, you know, we are going to be caught now. And they all were frightened. They started crying, and the footsteps got closer to the door.
There was a knock on the door. Their hearts stopped. They thought, this is it. But then they heard a familiar voice. It was Su Tao. He had come back to Laos from Thailand to rescue the rest of his family.
And they opened the door, and Uncle Su set you down. Don't worry, I'm going to take you guys.
He hired a bus and bribed some patrol guards to let them through. He talks about the journey in a documentary by Michael Corpy called City of Refuge.
May 14, 1975, on that day we lost our country to the communists, and we decided to flee to Thailand. Finally, we crossed the Mekong River safely into Thailand. We stayed in the refugee camp 10 months, and then we came to America.
Su's family was sponsored by the Third Reformed Church in Pella, Iowa, a Dutch immigrant town known as the City of Refuge. His family was the first to arrive in Iowa, but many others followed.
Pella is a small town in Iowa. It is like many other small towns, but this town is unmistakably Dutch. Many people in Pella are direct descendants of the Dutch immigrants who founded the city. This film is a record of how the Dutch immigrants opened their community to the new immigrants from Laos.
After a couple of years, Su got a job working for the Iowa Refugee Services in Des Moines. He helped new Hmong families acclimate and find jobs. He worked long hours translating.
I received a phone call, I might say almost 24 hours, even at work and at home. In the midnight, doctors, and they need interpretation, they just call me. Or refugees, they need help, they call me at home.
But Su and his family missed Pella, and they often drove back on the weekends to attend the Hmong Christian church. Su had been raised Christian in Laos. Su moved to Fresno in the early 90s. He wanted to be around a large Hmong community where he could find actors to dub film parts. Just this year, he had agreed to move to Minnesota, where several of his 9 children live. But in June, he had a stroke. He needed physical therapy, so he went to a rehab facility at a nursing home. His daughter, Von Tao, says the plan was to keep him there for 4 to 6 weeks and then bring him home. But instead, he got a fever and started shaking.
They just sent him to Clovis Community Hospital, and as soon as he got there, they tested him right away, and he was positive for coronavirus.
He'd been in high spirits, Vaughn says, but the virus made him so ill. She and her siblings saw him multiple times over a Zoom connection on the internet. The first day, he gave them the thumbs up. On the last day, July 30th, he had an oxygen mask.
And then we didn't think he could hear us, but he did. Because the way he was sitting was kind of like on his side. And the nurse was wiping tears with the tissue.
It was surreal, Vaughn says, even eerie, to watch her 72-year-old father die, not in person, but over a screen.
It was a real struggle to watch him breathe and not be able to. It was like watching him suffocate.
The disease is horrible, Vaughn says, but what she really hates is that people are dismissive when someone who is older dies from it.
Because the old people is somebody's mom or dad, or somebody's brother, uncle.
Somebody's brother, uncle, father. Su Tao was all that, but he was also someone who did so much for the Hmong community. If his life hadn't been cut short by the virus, Vaughn wonders, what other amazing things might he have done? For Valley Public Radio, I'm Alice Daniel.
Affordable housing is hard to find on the Central Coast. Smart Share Housing Solutions helps by matching homeowners who have extra bedrooms with those looking for an affordable place to live.
Good afternoon and welcome to The Nonprofit Story. This is Dr. Consuelo Mukes bringing you another episode with one of our wonderful nonprofits in San Luis Obispo County. Today I have with us Celeste Goyer, the Executive Director of Smart Share Housing Solutions. So Celeste, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Smart Share was started by a housing policy planner named Ann Wyatt back in 2015, who was interested in finding solutions to some of the struggles we have here with the shortage of affordable housing. And so she first started to look at what they call low-hanging fruit. What's the easiest thing that we already have within reach? And determined that there are many, many empty bedrooms or underused rooms in people's homes. And those people very often are single seniors on fixed incomes, struggling with the cost of housing, maintenance, taxes, etc. And it might be a nice program to come up with to find a way to turn those empty bedrooms into housing. And so she spent a couple of years setting up the board of directors, getting insurance, basically laying the groundwork. And then January 2017, our program Home Share Slow officially launched. Since then, we've matched 122 clients in housing, generating over $700,000 in financial benefits directly to the people participating in those home share matches.
So obviously there was a real need in our county and you're filling that need. Tell us a little bit about how this actually works.
Well, what it is a facilitated housemate matching program that's based on similar programs around the country. There are around 70 of them now. And we are members of our national industry association. So we share best practices and we're aware of other people's, how they're doing this. So it helps people find a housemate that's suitable for their room. It helps them with the interview process by providing lists of suggested questions. And we provide this multiple step process to help them work through it more thoughtfully and with the end goal of creating a stable match that's going to last for some time period, serving both sides with safe, affordable housing. It works. It's not an easy thing to do because when you bring someone into your home, there are challenges. You want to make sure you set expectations and set ground rules very carefully. So if that housing provider who has the empty bedroom is successful in selecting one of our housing seekers, the final step is for us to all sit down together and fill out a very detailed living together agreement with everything written down that we possibly can think of, from storage to quiet hours to where they're going to park, how it's going to end, everything possibly that we can come up with. And that's a big help. And then the match is launched, but our program stays involved with monitoring, and we're always available for questions. Yeah, so right now we have 26 current matches that we're supporting, and it's helping a lot of people.
So how do you assure the safety of the matches, the safety for the homeowner as well as the person who is renting? I mean, do you do background checks or something of that nature?
We do. Every client goes through a pretty rigorous set of background screens, everything from criminal to credit, to reference calls, to eviction database, to income check and sexual predator database, et cetera. There are a lot of steps to that. And that's a large part of the value that we provide to the home provider. But if you're really, really nervous about having someone come into your home, this may not be the program for you. And it certainly isn't suitable for everyone. Mm-hmm. But for those for whom the financial benefit is really important and key to them keeping their home, or for whom the isolation of living alone has been bad for their health, which we're finding out more and more about how bad it is, then it's all worth it. And also, I've got to say, going into it, we talked with a lot of people who ran these programs, and they assured us that problems were very few as far as the security you're talking about.
Right. Good. So do you just put people in San Luis Obispo City, or is it throughout the county?
It is throughout the county.
I looked on your website and you have a couple of interesting things there. One of them is your coffee chats.
We do informal gatherings that we call coffee chats. And prior to COVID, they were in coffee shops and kind of an open house setting where we just sit and talk about home sharing in general, our specific program and how it works, hear people's housing stories. And we got people from both sides of the equation, both seekers and providers, wanting to learn more about it, because it's not really that well known. Many people had a housemate in a roommate in college, but they may not have shared housing with non-family since then. We found just in an informal poll of meetings that we did, about 50% of people had never shared housing with non-family before. So we thought, okay, we need to sit down with people and answer their questions and hear their concerns. And so we started the coffee chat program, and it's been very fun. And we really look forward to talking with people and hearing their personal stories about their housing, because your house is your home and it's your heart and it's the most important thing often in your life. So now we've moved to the phone. Uh-huh. And we chose to do conference calls for our call-in coffee chat series that we're running now twice a month, because not everyone does have a computer or have internet or have Zoom capability. So in the interest of the fewer hurdles to talking to people, it's by conference call. And it's the second and fourth Wednesdays at noon. And you can go to our website at homeshareslow.org to get the phone number to call in, or call us at our office number and we'll get you the info you need.
Great. And we're going to repeat that information towards the end. So right now, what is the status of smart share housing solutions during this COVID crisis where we're all sheltering?
We are open and active. We are monitoring the public health recommendations as far as the scope of our activities. During the first total shutdown month or two, we were not operating except if people had a completely separate unit, one that was self-contained. And we did a couple matches in those. But since the slight relaxing of restrictions, we are open for those people who still want to find a housemate through our program. And we are supporting our current matches, which is always important, and particularly now, because everyone has questions about how to maintain safety in their home, how to have those conversations that might be difficult about visitors or behaviors or exposures. So we're doing that, and we just want to be sure that we're here when all this shakes out and more people are comfortable sharing that we're still here as a vital program so we can help the community.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas. This segment is part of a series called The Nonprofit Story. KCBX contributor Consuelo Mewkes is speaking with Celeste Goyer of Smart Share Housing Solutions.
You know, I think just another question that would come up is, do you just match for women, or is it for men or families or singles? Who is it for?
It is for anybody. It has turned out that the single senior woman is our most common client, but certainly not the only. We do have a lot of male seniors in the program. It does seem as though we don't have that many people, say, under the age of 30, because they tend to have their own apps and they're comfortable going online to do this, and sharing housing is not that alien to them. Mm-hmm. So for the most part, it is singles who have a hard time affording housing. We have a shortage of units, like studios and one bedrooms. There just aren't enough. As the demographics are shifting and more people are living alone, we definitely have too many three bedroom homes that are way too large for one person, not to mention completely unaffordable. So we don't have that many that are really suitable or able to take a family or a couple perhaps, but most of our home providers say they're only interested in one housemate. They don't have that much space to share. Some of them will take a single mother with one child, but it's not a program that's really helpful for families.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. So what are some of the match criteria and expectations? Can you just share just a couple of those with us?
Sure, but I also do want to just say, which I didn't add last time, was to the last question, families who are housing providers, definitely, because they may have an extra bedroom, and we can help their bottom line by taking in someone to rent that room.
That's an important point. Thank you.
Yes, so the biggies for match criteria, and this, by the way, is the most fun part of our it's not always fun to help people with their housing when they're, very stressed, but matching is kind of inherently fun. Right. And the big items are location, pets, smoking, and rent amount. And then a distant runner there is furnished or unfurnished. It's a big county, so that location piece is going to reduce the number of potential matches, introductions you can make between people considerably. And then pets. A lot of people do have a pet now. Not everyone is able or willing to take in that little dog or cat. But smoking, I've got to say, you smokers out there, I feel you, but we have very, very few home providers who will take you. So that's been a challenge. But rent amount, we average about $735 a month for our housing seekers. And that is, if anybody is keeping an eye on rent around here, average studio one bedroom is now around $1,200 to $1,400.
Wow.
Wow, I was right. So $730, $750 is looking pretty attractive.
So I was going to ask you about the future outlook, but I would think it's going to be a pretty positive thing if you can get the right matches, right?
Absolutely. And though we've had reduced client numbers, we've still been successful in bringing those people together. And in the future, as you say, when people are a little more comfortable bringing someone into their home, we know this need is only going to increase as people age. People want to continue aging in place. I'm sure. I mean, they figure, I don't even know why they bother getting the statistic, but over 95% of people want to stay in their homes as long as they possibly can. And so there are more of us who are aging into the category when the cost of living is outstripping our income and we may have more house than we need or we're seeking housing. So the need is there. It's going to increase, and we want to be there to continue helping.
SmartShares Housing Solutions is a nonprofit organization. Many times nonprofits need the public to help them to stay funded. Is that also true with this organization?
Yes, we have been fortunate to have private donors help us from the beginning. Mm-hmm. And so in addition to the funding that we get from grants and from the Community Foundation has been a wonderful supporter of us. And some of the cities, particularly the city of Morro Bay, I want to have a special shout out to them. Since the beginning, they gave us a little seed money and helped us with some funds from their general housing funds, the county. And some of the other cities have been able to use their in lieu of funding, which is affordable housing funding that they get from developers. And beyond that, we have maybe 13% or less is fees for service, because there are some fees to participate. There's a $50 screening and application fee for housing seekers. And for housing providers, the first month's rent is the program fee for them if we're successful in sending them someone that they decide to share with. But even so, that's only a small percentage of our operating funds. We are a tiny, lean nonprofit with 3 part-time staff, so we do things as affordably as we can. We have no office, but it's very hands-on, very people-oriented. There's no way to eliminate that, the hand and the heart in this job. So any donations are very much appreciated, and they go toward helping isolated seniors in their homes, to doing screening, and to facilitating these matches that make such a difference in people's lives.
And if people wanted to support you, would they go to your website?
Yes, there is a donation button on homeshareslow.org, which takes you to our donation page, where it's very easy to do.
Great. So Les, we have time. Can you give us maybe 1 or 2 quick stories on some matches?
Absolutely. Each match is different, but they do tend to fall into categories of type of service that it's providing. For instance, we often hear from families of elders. So we got a call from a gentleman who lived in Boston. His mother lived alone in a big family home in Los Osos. And her name is Lou. She had a couple extra bedrooms. She was okay and living independently and able to get by with the in-home services she was getting. But the son just wasn't comfortable any longer having her there alone in the home. So he called us up and we came and got her into the program. And they eventually chose a housemate who moved in, and they've been together now over a year. And they're just getting some more time for Lou to stay in her family home that was built by her husband from scratch, that she deeply loves and doesn't want to leave. So that's one way it can work. Then we also have homeowners like Donna in Templeton, who has a 3-bedroom home near the hospital, and she's very set up to age in place there, but had 2 extra bedrooms with really the occasional guest visiting. It didn't feel worthwhile to her. And so her financial bottom line was greatly helped by bringing in a gal named Mary, who was having a hard time finding a place to take her little dog. But Donna already had a couple dogs. All the dogs got along fine after a little bit of therapy. And Donna and Mary are now one of our longest running matches, over 2 years, I believe. And they even have traveled together. They became friends, which doesn't always happen. It's not what everybody's looking for. But when it does, it's very sweet.
Those are just samples, I know, of some of your great stories. And I'm hoping that a lot of people hear about this, because I do know that housing is a really critical need here in our county. So, Celeste, please give us some contact information for Smart Share Housing Solutions.
You're welcome to call our office at 805-215-5474. And then you can check out the currently available shares. There are photos and the rent amount and descriptions of the rooms is all there, plus information about how to qualify and other information about how the program works at homeshareslow.org. And those are the easiest ways to reach us.
And we've been talking today with Celeste Goyer, the Executive Director of Smart Share Housing Solutions. And this has been Dr. Consuelo Mutes. This is the Nonprofit Story. Thank you for joining us this afternoon.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. We'll be right back after a short break. This is Issues and Ideas on Central Coast Public Radio. Working Lunch is a weekly Facebook Live conversation between the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce and someone in the community doing interesting or innovative work. Today, we're hearing about local tourism from Chuck Davison of Visit SloCal.
Welcome to Working Lunch, the Slo Chamber's weekly series where we get to sit down with our community leaders and bring back some of that connection we've been missing during these challenging times. I'm Jim D'Antona, President and CEO of the Slo Chamber. Today, you'll get to sit in on my conversation with Visit SloCal CEO Chuck Davison. I'm so looking forward to talking with Chuck about the tourism industry, how lodging businesses throughout our county are adapting. Thank you for being here, Chuck.
Hi, Jim. It's good to be with you. I appreciate the opportunity to spend some time with you and the community across SloCal today. Our team's been back in the office since June 1st, and obviously, like everybody else, we made some tremendous cuts to our staff, and so we're able to do it socially distant.
Right out of the gate, the question you've probably answered 1,000 times at least, you know, what do you say to locals who are concerned about the impact of visitors on public health and the COVID-19 outbreaks?
Yeah, I get that question a lot. And as a resident, you know, I'm equally concerned, right? We call this beautiful place our home as well. It's not just the place that we work. My wife is concerned as well. So I get to answer for that one too. So, you know, for us, we've worked really hard since the beginning of this outbreak, working with the county, working with Dr. Borenstein, you know, making sure that the measures that were put in place were going to provide a safe path, not only for the visitors who are coming, but also for us as residents. All of our lodging investors, you know, we're unique in this county in that 80% of the lodging investors here are small business. They're mom and pops. And so they live here in this county. And so those people that own these hotels, you know, all throughout this destination, they're also residents, and they want to do the right thing, not only for keeping their employees safe, but keeping their visitors safe as well. And so I'm really proud of our industry. They've taken a leadership role throughout this entire process. And to date, there is not one outbreak reported from any lodging establishment inside the entire county. And I think that says a lot about how much they care about this destination and the people that live here.
How is Visits LoCal kind of supporting that healthy visitation that we're getting?
Yeah, you know, we hired a new chief marketing officer back in January. And so that's been an interesting introduction for her. Her name's Lisa Verbeck. She ran the marketing team at Tourism Australia. I think one of the really interesting things about that is, you know, Australia has, I think, 7 states. You know, we have 7 municipalities. So she got the push and pull between, you know, different destinations. But she's been really on the forefront of, you know, helping change our marketing strategy to adopt with the pandemic. And so if you were to go on our website today, you would see, you know, a plethora of photos of people in masks in different type of environments, right, that are helping to sell and educate. If you're going to come here, please respect our home. Please follow the rules accordingly. Please make sure that you're being safe. We led the charge with the county on the, you know, ultimately failed Start Guide initiative that they had put before the governor. But of the 13 different industries, we led the process on 4 of them to assure that we had the right people at the table developing the right measurements for the guide. And even though that wasn't ultimately accepted by the governor, the majority of those recommendations have all been put in place locally by our industry to assure that safety is occurring. We rolled out an open and safe toolkit that we pushed out across the entire county to make sure that individual businesses, not just lodging, but restaurants and wineries and attractions, all have the things that they needed, you know, in order to help be successful in this, you know, challenging time as well. So we're really pressing into that space. We're communicating in the blog posts and the things that we're pushing out, that people really need to respect the destination when they come here and, you know, keep it open. We won't stay open if we don't do the right thing.
And so one of those things that you're kind of talking about, and as you talked about that Start Guide that you were part of and working on the state level, are you working closely with the Visit California, our state tourism agency? And if so, can you tell us a little bit about their strategy?
You know, Visit California is really focused right now. One, it's important for people to understand that Visit California is a division of the government. So that's the California Office of Travel and Tourism. Things that Visit California are doing are being vetted and benchmarked, you know, through the governor's office and through the state health department. So that they're not out just doing things on their own, where, you know, they're following the guidelines as well. But their focus has really been to hold advertising until consumer sentiment for travel rises. Right now, only 52% of the residents in California are willing to travel. And so if you think about advertising to people in that stage, you know, you're throwing away 50 cents on the dollar before you even start the process. Now that's coupled by, unfortunately, huge outbreak and fires across the state, which really changed people's mindset. And so when we think about that, we really have to be cognizant of the things that are changing on a moment by moment basis. And so we're really leaning into Visit California and following their lead. As they start to advertise and open up more, we'll do the same.
Can you tell us what type of visitors we're welcoming right now? Where are they coming from? Where are they staying? How long are they here for?
Yeah, it's been really interesting to see. We had done some benchmarking early in May. We paid Oxford Economics, one of the largest research companies in the world that we work very closely with, to develop a 24-month forecast for us on what was going to happen to the travel space. And they projected that we wouldn't get back to 60% occupancy until March. Interestingly enough, we just got our July numbers 2 days ago, and we were at 60.4% for the month of July. And so, you know, we're seeing a lot of compression, especially in the beach communities, as the Inland Valley is hot and people are looking to get out of places like Los Angeles and San Francisco and into places that are less dense where there's more open space. Our beach communities have really done well this summer when we didn't think that we would have any visitation in the middle of a pandemic at all. So we're seeing a lot of visitors from the Central Valley, a lot of visitors from big communities. One of the challenges that that's creating is, you know, we traditionally try to market to what we call a high value customer, somebody who's willing to come, stay longer and spend a lot of money. And that's not necessarily the customer that we're seeing in the market right now. So we're actually seeing more people in the market today than we would this time a year ago. And that's mostly driven by, we have a lot of day trippers coming into the market from the Central Valley. And we have a lot of people who are coming and staying with more people in a room than, let me say, they should. So, you know, rooms have an occupancy limit of 4. We're seeing hotels on the coast with 6 and 8 people in the room, and that's creating some compression issues as well.
Does that give you any concern about where the tourism market's going, or is this just the blip during this time? Are there some ebbs and flows here that you're seeing that might cause negative things in the market?
Yeah, I think a little bit of both. I mean, we're all, you know, reading about the trash on the beach and the things like that. And what can happen with that is we bring this higher valued customer back into the market. If those things aren't addressed and taken care of appropriately, that customer can really get turned off to this place as a destination and say, hey, that's not somewhere that I want to go anymore. And so we really run the risk of brand harm for both SoCal as an overall region, but also individual cities. And so we're working really closely and pressing in with our coastal community cities to see how we can help, how we can continue to help message. Our work is to get people to the county. And then it gets picked up by the local municipalities and their tourism groups. But that's not going to work in today's world. We've got to extend past that and be communicating to people once they're in market, just from the challenges that are faced. Now, with that said, there's a big question on, you know, what does leisure travel look like over these next couple of months? As September and October come to a close, which is traditionally the end of leisure travel season, we have a tendency to rely more in the travel space on business travel and meetings and conference. Business travel is probably not going to happen this fall, and meetings and conferences definitely are not going to happen. And so what does that look like for the travel space? And at that same time, you could have banks that are calling in loans on hotels and other establishments that, you know, for debt that needs to be paid. We run the risk of kind of a perfect storm in that space occurring if things don't maintain. The upside on that is, you know, the customers who would traditionally be traveling internationally can't travel internationally. And so they're looking for destinations that are different than where they've gone before. So we just launched this PR initiative with 25 major publications across the U.S. that we're working with on a kind of European vacation scenario for the Central Coast. You know, you can come and enjoy the wineries and enjoy the outdoor space and all of these things, and trying to, you know, move people from where they would have been going to where they can go today.
You know, 80% of our hoteliers are local. Does that make them more susceptible potentially to, you know, a closure, a bank, or calling in the loan versus the big guy?
Our larger local lodging investors who have 3, 4, 5 properties, they're working for the most part with local banks. And so those banks are equally invested in this community, and they want to find a way to make that work. We don't have a lot of partners. We have some partners that have 8, 10, 12, 16 properties that are based in Southern California, but, you know, have a dominant presence here and have leadership living in our market. And they're probably vested with larger banks. I was with a hotel partner, and they were saying, hey, we're looking to invest in additional properties. So if you hear of anything that's coming up for sale, let us know. And that's a really interesting phenomenon right now in the middle of a crisis when travel isn't doing well. You know, I mean, overall, there's been no industry that's been more decimated by COVID than travel outside of healthcare, right? I mean, healthcare has obviously been the most impacted, but travel has been right behind it, whether you're talking about air service or hotels or restaurants or, you know, just leisure in hospitality in general. So I think for the most part, our hotel partners here are here because this is where they want to be. It's here because this is what they want to do. And they're going to find a way, whether it's through private or public investment, to pull through and make it work.
Yeah, a great way to summarize it. I think that's how I see it too. I know we had a similar experience of being a visitor to SLO before moving to and working here?
Yeah, you know, I love that scenario because we talk about the economic ecosystem and we work it like this. You know, if you build a place that people want to visit, you'll build a place that people want to live. And if you build a place that people want to live, you'll build a place that people want to work. And if you build a place that people want to work, you'll build a place that business has to be. And if you build a place that business has to be, you'll build a place that people want to visit. And so it's this ecosystem that, you know, everything starts with a visit. You don't choose to move to a market. You don't choose to open a business in a market, you know, unless you've been there as a visitor.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. The San Luis Obispo Chamber's Jim D'Antona is speaking with Chuck Davison of Visit SloCal.
As we look at the success of what needs to happen and how we maintain it, I think it goes back to relationships. You know, I tell people all the time, look, don't wait to develop the relationship until you need it, because it's going to be too late at that point. I mean, the reason we're successful even right now in working with the local government in the work that we're doing is because we've been working with them for the last 5 years and they trust us. As we think about how we continue to press through the relationships that we built with the airlines are challenging space right now. But I'll tell you, the airport is doing extremely well in the face of this adversity. The airport's performing in the top 10 non-hub airports for passengers every single week. American Airlines had announced that they were cutting 15 markets across the United States, just getting rid of the service. And fortunately, we weren't in that mix, right? And so we continue to push in to our partners at United and American and Alaska. And, you know, we really believe Kevin and I had a plan from the very beginning. As long as we didn't lose service to a market, we can grow the service back. And we've been fortunate that in both Dallas and Denver, we've maintained the service. We lost some service between LA and San Francisco, but we still have multiple flights a day. And we know that we can go from 2 flights a day back to 5. If we had gone to 0, it gets really hard to get back to 5 because if they're not here, it's hard to start them here again. We see that in Santa Maria, where United was expected to launch, right? Now they've pulled all service out and they're not launching. And it originally was a delay. Now they're not launching at all. So, you know, we're going to continue to really push into those relationships that we have. And, you know, again, because our market is already outperforming what the forecast was, we're in a really fortunate position with those air carriers to see more service come back soon.
Everybody is kind of moving and changing, and all the tourism industry is experiencing right now. You know, there's an opportunity to rethink and reimagine the standard way of doing things. So do you have some thoughts about what it would look like for the conference center or hotels or the way individuals travel? And have any of the sacred cows been slayed during this time?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. The hotel space over the last probably decade has really come a long way. It's really evolved. You know, it used to be you'd check into this standard kind of hotel and every room looked the same and the lobbies all looked the same. And one of the things that's come out of this is at a Hilton, right, they're telling you in advance, check in online. Don't come to the front desk. You know, check in through your app. Get your room key on your phone. So those advancements were already starting to come, but this whole move to a touchless environment, that move to touchless is going to be advancing. I think one of the challenges that that creates for the industry is the hospitality industry has always been face-to-face. And so how do you maintain the connectivity with that when you're trying to move everybody into a mobile, you know, scenario? That's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. In the conference space, you know, Business Insider published a big article back in June where they featured Hotel Slow on the new conference space that they have that opens up to the outside. And, you know, for places like ours, that's an amazing opportunity because we have amazing weather. So there's some really great things like that that could help propel the industry forward in a new and different way. They're getting rid of things like throw pillows and throw blankets. And, you know, all of that stuff is going to be a thing of the past. And, you know, they're really talking about how they make it a tight and clean environment, but not stale. With every challenge, there's an opportunity, right? And so how do we take advantage of it?
You're on a plane, you're seeing it, the process working.
Yeah, I think they're doing a really good job. You know, MIT released a report about 3 weeks ago that talked about the cleanliness of planes. And it showed that if you're traveling in a plane, you had a 1 in 4,500 chance of getting COVID. Your chance of getting COVID in the grocery store is 1 in 100. So, you know, I think the thing that people don't realize about planes is they use the same air circulation system that hospitals use. And that air is processed through there at a really fast and consistent rate. And everybody's wearing a mask and they're doing the right thing. And the planes are getting defogged in between. And I believe this is what the world looks like for the next 12 months. And so, you know, we have to keep our business moving. And so we're taking every precaution, making sure that we're wearing masks. We're making sure that we got hand sanitizer and we're washing our stuff and taking care of it. But the world has to go on, in my opinion. And so we're going to keep pressing forward. And we believe SloCal deserves greatness. And that's what we're here to try to deliver.
Thanks so much.
Great. Thanks, Jim. Great to be with you.
That was San Luis Obispo Chamber's Jim D'Antona's conversation with Chuck Davison of Visit SloCal. The nonprofit Partners in Education runs a program called Computers for Families to help bridge the digital divide. They refurbish donated computers and accessories to give to families throughout Santa Barbara County. Contributor Beth Thornton talked with two members of the organization about the growing need for equipment and connectivity.
This is Beth Thornton. Today's conversation is about Computers for Families, a program run through the nonprofit Partners in Education in Santa Barbara County. I'm joined by Executive Director Chelsea Duffy and Development Associate Erica Terrazas. Chelsea, let's start with a brief overview of the program and how it works.
Computers for Families connects students and families with technology in the home, as well as support that they need to get connected to internet. And we do this with the help of community donations from large corporations and individuals who have gently used devices or accessory items such as monitors, keyboards, mice, and they donate those. We refurbish them and then get them back out, repurposing them and putting them in the hands of families and individuals that don't have this technology or enough of this technology in their homes.
The program is part of the County of Education's Partners in Education, but it's separate from schools distributing Chromebooks to students, correct?
Correct. So Partners in Education is a nonprofit that is administered by the Santa Barbara County Education Office. So Computers for Families has a long history of partnership with the County Education Office and was created in order to close the digital divide and supplement what schools are doing for their students. Schools are not able to provide every member of a family with all of the tools, or we're kind of filling in the gaps where and so working very closely with schools to make sure that their students have what they need to be successful.
And it's called Computers for Families, so it's not just for students. It's about getting the whole family online.
We are supporting parents who are in turn trying to support their students. We have also, in the wake of COVID-19, expanded our services to support anyone who needs a device in Santa Barbara County. And we've opened it up, recognizing that the need is so widespread and goes beyond even students. However, student population continues to be our largest group served.
How many families do you typically serve?
We have served over 12,000 to date, and we typically, or in a really big year, our highest number was about 600 families served. In the COVID period alone, so just in the last 5 months, we have served over 600 families. So you can get a sense of just how big this demand is when, you know, our biggest year in the past is what we've seen in just the last less than half a year.
What does it mean if you don't have a device in the home right now?
So if you don't have the tools, participating in school is just not an option. It's really a requirement. It's become something more so than ever before, a requirement for school. And so the urgency with which schools have been working and reaching out to their families, and then in turn working with us to reach out to their families, has greatly intensified during this period of time, because we know that it's truly a necessity now.
Erica, is there a waiting list for families in need of equipment?
There is currently not a wait list. We do have a high number of calls each day, so our team puts families in a list and then reaches out to them. Our outreach list is about 50 families a week.
So is the 50 families per week a higher number than usual because of the pandemic?
Our calls are about 20 a week in a normal situation, and they have increased.
Do you find that some of those phone calls are coming from senior citizens or families with senior citizens who are trying to stay connected while they're at home?
Yes, we've gotten various calls of seniors who are needing a device and who otherwise either can't afford one or are unable to go out and purchase one because they don't know what type of device they need. So they reach out to us.
So let's walk through how the program works. Community members donate gently used equipment. You have it refurbished, and then you install it in the homes of people who need it. And beyond that, there's training and support. Is that correct?
For families and for students, it's not enough to just give them, and individuals in general, we feel that it's not enough to just give people the tool, the technology itself. We then need to empower the users to use their devices safely and with confidence. And so often when students are being given their devices, they may be with parents who are very unfamiliar with the technology, or this is their first experience with a computer in the home. We have, to give you an idea of the population that we're seeing come to us, I believe it's about 60% say that they have little to no experience with computers. So to be giving them a device is just one step of what is needed. We're also then needing to provide some training and technical support. So we're following up every interaction with a phone call. Our team is wanting to develop relationships and establish trust with the families. And so by doing a follow-up phone call, asking if there's other support that's needed, making sure that they were in fact able to get the computer set up and working is an important piece. And then beyond that, what questions do you have in keeping your kids safe? What questions do you have in making sure that your students are connected to their online learning or the homework assignment that you have? And so what we've started is weekly virtual coaching or online classes in a way where we have a staff person both in English and in Spanish working with small groups of mostly parents who come to us with some of these more personal questions.
Do you still work with Los Prietos Boys Camp?
We have a long history with the Los Prietos Boys Camp. In the past, the young men who were part of the school would play a really critical role in refurbishing the devices themselves. How it's evolved most recently is that those young men who are preparing to enter back into society have worked with our program by coming out to our distribution events. So the events where families would come out and pick up their computer, get an orientation and a basic safety training, and they would act as translators or sit down with families and answer questions. So they were getting some really great experience interacting with families and giving back to the community. With our social distancing in place and not being able to gather large groups, we've had to put that on pause. We're eternally indebted to the Los Prietos Boys Camp. This program would not be what it is without that history, and we hope to be able to revitalize that and get it going again when we're able to gather and involve the boys in our work again.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about Computers for Families, a program in Santa Barbara County. Who upgrades the equipment or who makes sure that it's all working before it goes out to the families?
Walter LaRiba on our team, who's been with the County Education Office for over 10 years and is an expert in refurbishing devices and in getting them loaded with the software that they need, wiping them when they come to us as a donation. And we also benefit from volunteers and interns who help with that process as well.
We've been talking about the hardware, the equipment side of the equation. How do you go about getting internet connected to families as well?
Well, I'll start by kind of describing our partnership with Cox, and then Erica can go into the detailed and some of the challenges that families face in getting connected, because there's so many issues that I become more aware of every time I hear about our calls. But we're very lucky to have a very strong partnership with Cox and their staff that run the Connect to Compete program, which is discounted internet for those that qualify. And we have a direct line of communication with Cox staff, and that allows for so many troubleshooting opportunities to happen and for us to help get information to people who would otherwise be waiting and would be experiencing much longer delays. So because we have this great partnership, we're able to help families navigate some of the challenges in getting connected to internet.
We did a lot of research on North County and hotspots that are being offered, working with the districts to know how many hotspots are available for families. Often we learned that families haven't gone to the school to find out if they have any options. So we just remind them, have you talked to your district, and give them as many options as possible.
I would add that through this process, we're able to play a liaison role between the internet service provider and the customer. And so often we're learning of challenges that individuals face in getting connected to internet and then being able to communicate that back to Cox, for example, and solutions emerge from that.
Let's talk about how people can donate and what specifically you need.
Donations for hardware are very much needed, as we are distributing an average of 50 computers each week in order to maintain that stream of donations going out to the community. We need to maintain a high level of hardware donations coming back in to us. So we're looking for Windows-compatible CPUs. We're looking for monitors, for keyboards, for mice, for noise-canceling headphones, for webcams, anything that would help with student learning as far as computer hardware is really important. But the CPUs, Windows 10 compatible, is the top need for us. Those donations can be made by appointment only. We have a donor registration and appointment form on our website, partners.sbceo.org. And we will set up an appointment in order of readiness. So if you're ready to donate in the next week, we will set up an appointment for you in the next week. But we're also really encouraging companies that know that they're going to be replacing their computers 3 months out, 6 months out, a year out. If you know that you are going to soon be replacing employee computers, let us know in advance so then we can plan our inventory accordingly.
And for people who are requesting a computer, they also go online and fill out a form?
For anyone who's requesting a device, they can call our number, which is 805-964-4710, extension 4401, fill out a phone application with us, and then we will schedule an appointment so they can pick up their device.
Is there anything else that either of you want to add?
Huge thank you to the community, because this is truly a community-born program and a program that only exists because of the hardware donations that come in. We have learned that the digital divide is still very much there, and it just has simply changed and evolved over time. It is no longer about having a device in the home. It's now about multiple types of technology and different knowledge and training opportunities available. The challenges and issues that face people are more varied now. So it's not as simple as just getting somebody a computer. So we're very grateful that there was foresight by those that started the program over 20 years ago, and that it continues to be such a resource and such a tool for change and for support in today's world.
Thank you so much, Chelsea Duffy and Erica Terrazas from Computers for Families. This is Beth Thornton for Issues and Ideas.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments. It's at kcbx.org.